case, which is 10-AP-3034-CR, State v. Kenneth M. Sobachak. Is that essentially how he pronounces his name? Okay. And arguing on behalf of Mr. Sobachak is Andrew Hinkle, Assistant State Public Defender. Mr. Hinkle, the podium is yours.
Chief Justice Abrahamson, and may it please the Court. I plan to address the issues in this case today in the order of the briefing, though I have by far the most to say about the first issue, which I think is really at the core of this case, and that issue is, that question is, whether Ms. Padella, as a weekend guest, actually had the authority to allow Officer Dorn into the Sobchak household. The question can be stated more generally, as whether when one invites a guest into one's house, one is effectively inviting the government in at the discretion of that guest. I think that the answer to the question can be found both in the cases of this court and in the cases of the United States Supreme Court, and that the answer is no. When we invite guests into our home, we choose to invite some and exclude others, and it doesn't constitute turning over authority over the home to the guest. We can start with United States versus Matlock, which is, of course, the seminal case on common authority. And that case, in the famous footnote that describes what common authority is and who has it, the court said that it belongs to persons generally having joint access or control for most purposes, so that it is reasonable to recognize that any of the co-inhabitants has the right to permit the inspection in his own right, and that the others have assumed the risk that one of their number might permit the common area to be searched.
At the beginning, let me just dispense with something that's causing me just a little bit of trouble. Would you be making the same or a similar argument if that morning she left the house with the computer, went to a local coffee shop, was sitting there using the computer, and law enforcement's at the coffee shop, and this pornography pops up and she says, hey, take a look at this. What's going on here? Would you be making the same argument? I mean, you wouldn't make it regarding the house. Would you be arguing that she didn't properly have access to the computer then?
No, I don't think that we would be able to sustain that position.
Okay, so you think that'd be a loser, right? Okay, so the whole argument in your viewpoint hinges on the fact that the computer, the laptop, was still in the house
when
law enforcement viewed it.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead. Is there an added layer to the analysis, given that it is a computer within the house as opposed to a shoebox that had the top off and that was sitting on the coffee table around the sofa?
I don't really think so. That's not how I view the case. I think that what we're talking about ultimately is the degree of intrusion, well, that there was an intrusion into the Sobchak household, and that what was going on there was examining the contents of the household. Now, whether that be a shoebox or whether it be a computer, I suppose, you know, there could be factual differences that would contribute to a hypothetical different case. But no, I think it's essentially the question is whether the police can walk into the house and look at something.
Well, the police did not walk into the house in the sense that they knocked on the door and said, hey, we heard there was a burglary in the neighborhood and we're wondering if the person came to your house. Or MG&E didn't come in and say, hey, we think there's a gas leak in the neighborhood, so we want to investigate the gas leak. She called them into the house. You know, this is an affirmative act on her part to bring him into the house. It's not her saying when someone knocks on the door, you can come in on the assumption that that's what the owner, or here the boyfriend, would have done. She calls them.
That's correct, and I think that ultimately the question in this case boils down to her authority to do that. I mean, there's no question, obviously, that as a factual matter, she consented to the officer coming into the house. And I don't know that it matters whether she initiated the contact or whether the officer showed up for some other reason. The question is, does she have common authority over that house such that she could let the officer in?
Okay, are you going to discuss apparent authority, actual authority?
I was planning on discussing both of those,
okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Let me ask you just a variation of my coffee shop thing. The officer came to the house and he said, are you more comfortable bringing the computer out to me or do you want me to come into the house? And she said, oh, just come on in. If she would have brought the computer, the laptop, outside, would you be making the same argument?
No, I don't think that I would in that case.
That'd be
either.
Like the coffee shop?
It would be closer to the coffee shop, yeah. I mean, the law of a private search, essentially, is that if she has, essentially, if a person has the right to be there, it sort of seems like they can go and get something.
Mr. Henkel, does the record reflect whether Mr. Sobchak put any parameters on his girlfriend's access to any parts of the house?
Well, Officer Dorn testified that she wasn't limited to any part of the house. I'm not sure where he got that information, if that was something that she told him. It's not explicit in the record.
And then the same question would go for her use of the computer. It seems to me that the record reflects that he simply indicated to her that she had his permission to use the computer.
I believe that's correct, Justice Gableman.
And so extending Justice Ziegler's hypothetical one more step, if instead of calling the police to the residence, if Mr. Sobchak's girlfriend had elected rather to take the computer directly to the police station and say, here's what I found, I'm going to guess that your answer would be similar to Justice
Ziegler's. My answer would be similar, yes. Oh. The entire gravamen of this case is that what we're talking about is a police entry into the house, which is the most protected area of the under the Fourth Amendment.
And the police may have had probable cause to get a search warrant to enter the house and did ultimately get a search warrant to look at the computer.
Did get a search warrant to look at the computer. Once the computer was already at the police station.
Right.
Yes.
Counsel, if you could help me with this. It refers to footnote 7 that you just read from in the case of United States versus Matlock. And the end of that footnote is, as you stated, the question is, so that it is reasonable to recognize that any of the co-inhabitants has the right to permit the inspection in his own right, and that others, now I'm getting to the punchline of my question, and that others have assumed the risk that one of their number might permit the common area to be searched. Sometimes when I read discussion about Matlock, it is in a more general area. That is, that they have assumed the risk that the cohabitant or the visitor or whatever the person is that spilled the beans, that they have assumed the risk that that person might invite someone else in. And so it's much broader than the Matlock language. The Matlock language says that they have assumed the risk that one of their number might permit the common area to be searched, which speaks to me of search by law enforcement as opposed to a nosy neighbor. Has Matlock subsequently been interpreted by the United States Supreme Court to be broader than the language that you just read and that I just read?
Not at all, Justice Bradley. in fact, and I would point out that, yes, there is this language about assume the risk, but that's at the end of a very long sentence, the first part of which lays the preconditions for which we might reasonably assume that the person has assumed the risk that their co-occupant will consent to a search. Words like generally having joint access describes the person who might be able to consent. Now, a house guest certainly has some limited access for a limited period of time, but it's simply not the case that Ms. Podella generally had joint access and control of the house.
Our inquiry then, in part, is it reasonable to believe that the defendant here allowed the weekend guest, assumed the risk that a weekend guest would allow law enforcement to come into the common area and search? Is that like a precise legal question, or is that not?
No, I don't think that is the precise legal question, for a couple reasons. First, again, Matlock and all the cases succeeding it assume that what we're talking about is people who live in the house. Second of all, as a general matter, these common authority cases are not predicated on the particular arrangements or the particular understandings of the people involved. They're predicated on what's the general social understanding of what, you know, what the relationship is between the consenting party and the premises.
Well, do you think it's an objective test rather than a subject?
Rather than a subjective test.
That's correct. And the court said that, I think it was in Randolph. You know, it sort of discussed at length what the general idea is when people share a house. You know, who can do what as a general matter? And it says, well, there might be instances in which people have peculiar arrangements about who can let who into the house. But the cops don't have to look into that. They can just they go by what is the general social understanding of what it means to be a co-inhabitant.
So the question more correctly stated would be something like this. Would a reasonable person in the position of the defendant assume the risk that, I forget her name.
Padella is how I say it. I don't.
Padella would allow law enforcement in the common area of the house to be searched.
I suppose it could be phrased that way. I guess there's another level of abstraction where you could say, would a person observing the situation from the outside believe that that someone who allows a guest into their house is assuming the risk that the guest is going to let other people into their house?
I didn't quite mean That's exactly the focus of my question. My earlier question, was it reasonable to believe they would assume the risk to allow other people in the house? That's not what Matlock apparently talks about. Is it reasonable to believe they would assume the risk to allow someone to come in and search the house? Isn't
correct.
That Matlock?
How would anybody ever reasonably assume that they're going to let the police in the house? I mean, if this guy thought the police were anywhere around, I don't see how any person would ever fit that standard. Is it reasonable to assume I want the police to come in my house and find out the laws I've been breaking? I mean, come on, you're never going to get a yes to that test.
I agree with that, and that's why I don't really think that that's the test. I think that the test is, again, given the relationship between the consenting party and the premises, is it reasonable to believe that the person has the right to allow other people into the house? And, you know, my answer to that question is quite simply no.
What's that answer based on? If you're a house guest, say a friend loans you the use of a condo for the weekend, and you decide to have some other people over for dinner. If the guest had no express parameters or prohibitions to inviting social guests, under your analysis, the guest would not be allowed to invite friends over for lunch or dinner?
No, I don't think that's the test, because in Georgia versus Randolph, the court talks about, it's a little bit more specific than just let anyone into the house. The court in Georgia versus Randolph talks about whether it's reasonable to imagine that the person consenting has the authority to let a person who is obnoxious to the householder into the house. That is, and in this case, of course, at the very least, we have a police officer who's a stranger to Mr. Sobczak and whose presence in the house is going to do him damage. It's not simply a question of would you ever let anyone into the house, would you let the pizza guy in the front door if he brought you a pizza, or would you let a Girl Scout in the front door if she was selling cookies. The question is, did the visitor have, do we as a society recognize that this person in the house has the authority to let people in even if the householder wouldn't want them in there? Because that's what co-occupant consent says. That's what they said in Georgia versus Randolph. They said, if I'm gone and my roommate lets someone in, I don't really have the right to object.
How could that standard be applied proactively? I mean, people, situations change. Someone who might not be obnoxious when they arrive could turn into something different during the stay.
Well, sure. But again, I mean, the presence of a law enforcement officer investigating a crime that you committed is contrary to your interest. And in this case, certainly Ms. Padilla was aware of that.
So the rule, what is the rule that you're proposing? What it sounds to me like you're proposing is if a house guest has the run of the house and has not been excluded from inviting people in, nonetheless, the house guest may never allow the police into a person's residence.
I would say that, yes, the rule that I support is that a house guest does not have common authority over a residence. The people who have common authority over a residence, which is what allows them to let the police in, are occupants. Well, I think that's what Matlock said. It's what Rodriguez said. It's what Randolph said. And
you just broadened it on me, though. I think you just made the exception that for the social visitor or the pizza delivery person or the Boy Scout or Girl Scout, whatever you said. It sounds to me, and I might be wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, that the house guest may invite social visitors in, but may not invite law enforcement in. Is that the specific rule that you propose?
We don't make laws about who can invite house guests, who can invite Girl Scouts into the house. The question here, again, is whether law enforcement could rely on Ms. Padilla's consent to go into the house. And I think
because
actually,
the Fourth Amendment is against government.
That's correct.
And the house and social guests who snoop around may have the owner, the young man here, may have other remedies against them, but not Fourth Amendment.
That's correct. And you know, it is my opinion. I think it's a well-supported opinion as a member of this society that if I had a house guest over and unbeknownst to me, they invited other people over to my house, not with having made previous arrangements to do so or other people that I know or whatever, but if they just invited other people over into my house, I would feel that they had violated my trust. And it's not just my opinion. It's also the opinion of the United States Supreme Court.
Part of the goal here is to have people be reasonably assured that law enforcement can't just enter their house anytime.
Right.
They have to have a warrant. They have to have consent. There has to be some exception. And I get that, and I like that. That's part of our constitutional protection against unreasonable searches and seizures. So the lesson to be taught to law enforcement, should the case go your way, is when you have a laptop, have the person bring it out to you. Don't walk in the house. I get your argument. If they walk in the house to look at the laptop and they see cocaine on the table, then you want to suppress the cocaine because they had no right to be in there, and so they should have never discovered the cocaine. That would, in part, you know, then you'd have plain view and other arguments that go along with that. But you'd say they wouldn't see that but for their entry in the house, and that wouldn't be tethered to owner of the house, but for their entry in the house. But the lesson really here is, I mean, it's not like a lot of these cases, law enforcement is sort of trying to get in, you know. They're trying to find a way, you know, in. And the person that lets them in either says nothing and just kind of opens the door and they walk in with the person saying nothing, or they say, you know, the issue becomes whether that's a consent that they can give. But here, law enforcement said, what's your preference? Do you want to bring the laptop out to me, or do you want me to come in? And the person said, I want you to come in. So that in and of itself means this was law enforcement acting unreasonably.
Certainly, because the question is whether she had the authority to do that, to consent to officer.
So law enforcement ought to just, I mean, the lesson, because they're going to take a lesson from this, is next time they don't say, can I have consent to enter the home, the next time is they either conduct an inquiry as to what that person's doing there, how long they've been there, do they have the ride, is this a common area? They should go down a litany of questions before they're willing to cross the threshold. Or they ought to just say, bring me the computer, and then they're safe.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that very last.
Or they just say, you know, bring the computer out to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that points out. Officer Dorn had several lawful options for getting a hold of this computer, and he chose to go into the house, cross the threshold, which, of course, brings the Fourth Amendment into play. I think, you know, there are several lessons in this case, if it comes my way, one of which is that there's a simple bright-line test for who can let the officer into the house, and that is, do you live here? Now, there's probably test edge cases in that case, too. But, I mean, someone who's staying for the weekend, they know they're a guest. The police officer knows they're a guest. Everyone knows they're a guest. And I guess I just wanted to point out that in Minnesota versus Olson, the Supreme Court articulated a view of what our social expectations are of guests that's very well in line with what I'm saying the social expectation is. They said that even though a guest is likely not to be limited to a particular part of the house, that is, to have the run of the house, and even though in the guest absence they'll have a measure of, in the host's absence they'll have a measure of control over the house as a practical matter, nevertheless, very few guests are going to invite other people in without their host's permission. And the court said, therefore, they don't have the legal authority to let people into the house, despite the fact that they have a privacy interest. Now, the state has argued that the privacy interest equates to the authority to let people into the house, but the Supreme Court said exactly the opposite. They said that it exists despite the lack of authority to allow someone into the house.
Counsel, what do you expect this court to say, and how does it differ from what the Court of Appeals said?
I would like this court to say that, first of all, common authority is limited to to those who live in a house. Actual co-occupants of the house, as the United States Supreme Court has said. Second of all, there's no distinction between a search of a house and an entry into a house. Once an officer steps past the threshold and begins to see things inside the house you couldn't see otherwise, that's a search. The United States Supreme Court is quite clear about that in Kylo. They said even a fraction of an inch. They said even viewing the non-intimate vestibule rug by cracking open the front door brings on the full protection of the Fourth Amendment. The important line is the threshold. I see that my time is running short, so I could turn to apparent authority if the court is interested in hearing what I have to say about it. First of all, I explained in my brief, it's very clear that Officer Dorn knew the same facts that we know. This is the only source of information in the record. He spoke with Ms. Padilla on the threshold for 10 minutes, got all the information that then got into the record. So he knew who she was, why she was there. The state has maintained that nevertheless, you know, maybe this is kind of a close case legally and therefore we should give them the benefit of the doubt. But that's not how the law works. The Fourth Amendment, it has always been the case that courts decide what the law is. And they hold up the officer's actions to the law, and if they fit, well then, it's a good search, and if they don't, it's not. What the apparent authority doctrine says is we don't demand that the law enforcement officer be 100% correct about the facts. And Rodriguez says that over and over again, factual errors, factual determinations. The state has seized on one line that is just really a quote from Terry to suggest that, oh, maybe it's, tie goes to the runner. But I really don't think that that's the law, and I don't think there's any support for that position. I can also turn to the issue of remand, if the court is interested.
That goes to the fact that there was a search warrant here and that if it was independent of the illegal,
which
you allege
source.
Is illegal, then it can be let in, but that was not raised below. Is that your point?
That's my point, that it's thoroughly waived and that the theory isn't really developed and there's just no reason not to hold state to the same waiver that any other
and,
litigant would be held
and
to.
And the state doesn't say we can make that decision here on the basis of this record. As I understand the state's position, they want a remand to the trial court to make the record.
That's correct. That's correct.
You want to say anything else about that?
I could go into greater detail on the independent source rule and inevitable discovery, but I'd actually prefer to spend the rest of my time talking about actual authority if
and you should do that.
If that's amenable. I want to talk a little bit about the language in the famous Lefebvre paragraph that has become really, I guess, the source of this case. First of all, what Lefebvre said, and he's really laying out a very narrow exception back in 1978. He says someone who is more than a casual visitor may consent to the police entry into a place where a visitor would ordinarily be received. And I just wanted to point out that, first of all, having the run of the house does not make you more than a casual visitor, not being limited in where you can go. I don't think very many people let guests into their house and say, okay, you can be in the living room, but don't go in the kitchen, or you can go in the kitchen, but don't use the microwave. I think that's just the ordinary position of a visitor, and that's what the United States Supreme Court said in Randolph, that ordinarily guests are not limited in where they can go in the house. Second of all, I just wanted to point out that nowhere in the record here does it actually say that the search occurred in the living room. The circuit court found that, and the state says it in their brief. When I searched the entire record, I searched Officer Dorn's testimony. All we have from Officer Dorn is that it was on a couch and that it was 20 or 30 feet past the front door. Now, to get some perspective on this, I took a tape measure at my house, and I found that by the time you get 30 feet past my front door, you can be in my backyard. You can be virtually anywhere in my house. So I don't think that we have a case that fits into the little exception that Lefebvre drew. And I think, in fact, if we apply the exception in that way, we essentially swallow what he says is the general rule, which is that a visitor cannot consent to a search. I see that my time has expired, so if there are no further questions, I'll cede the floor.
Thank you, counsel, and you'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Warren Weinstein, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. Counsel.
Thank you, Chief Justice. My name is Warren Weinstein. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the state of Wisconsin, and I represent the state in this case. I think that there are a number of factors for why Ms. Padilla had authority to permit Officer Dorn to enter the house. And I think it does matter that it was not a search, but merely an entry. The level of intrusion is almost always part of the balancing in determining whether a particular challenged action of the police under the Fourth Amendment is reasonable. And that is ultimately the test, whether or not the officer's action was reasonable.
Isn't this a consent case?
I'm sorry?
Is this not a consent case?
It is.
And if she hadn't consented, she made the phone call and she said, oh, I've got pornographic material on this computer in my boyfriend's house. And the police came and she wasn't there. And she didn't consent on the phone. And she wasn't there to consent. And they walked into the house.
Then we'd be talking about whether or not there was probable cause and exigent circumstances.
Okay. I'll give you probable cause. You'd have to still find exigent circumstances to get into a house, which is very difficult. So my point is, what difference does it make as to the level of intrusion? This is a consent case. And will it not turn on consent?
Well, this court recognized a different level of intrusion for consent in Tomlinson. So, yeah, I think it does matter.
Okay. But do we agree that you got to have consent here by a valid person?
I'm sorry?
Do we agree that you have to have consent here by a person who has authority to consent?
If by authority you mean from one who has the right to consent in their own right and where the owner has assumed the risk, then yes.
Okay.
But I think that is the case here. First of all, Ms. Padilla, as an overnight guest, had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the house. To me, that is the right to consent in their own right. And the second thing is, did Mr. Sobotchek assume the risk when he left her for however long it was, apparently a pretty long time, to go to work as the only adult in the house without any restrictions at all? And it seems to me that whether or not we're talking about someone entering where guests would normally be received versus whether or not we're allowing them to go into a bedroom to determine whether or not there's a firearm there is quite a bit different, and it plays into the analysis of whether or not the consent, the officer's belief that he had consent to do what he did was reasonable. And that's the question. The question is whether or not, under all the facts, Officer Dorn's judgment that he had consent to go in and look at that computer was reasonable. That's really the only question under the Fourth Amendment.
Do you think it makes any difference that, I mean, defense counsel said, had she brought the computer outside, or had she been in a coffee shop, or had she taken it to the police station, he wouldn't be here arguing this. That the thing to be searched was properly searched. It's just the problem here is that instead of her taking it to him or being in a different place other than a home, she invited him in to look at it. The thing, the area, the item, the subject of the contraband could have been searched anywhere. It just happened to be in the house. Does that have any significance at all in this issue? I mean, it's different if you've got the firearm and the firearm is under the mattress in the bedroom. It's different if you have the rolls of money from the robbery that are stuffed in the couch. It's different if you have the box of drugs that's in the cupboard in the kitchen. You know, the area to be searched isn't a computer that could be searched anywhere. You know, a laptop that could be searched anywhere. That makes no difference to you?
Well, I guess I see a couple of questions there. The first one was, would we still be here? And we might, because in the Court of Appeals, he contested whether or not she had authority to consent to the search of the computer itself. That's not in the case anymore. I do think the fact that she had his permission to search to use the computer, and the Court of Appeals found that she therefore had authority to consent to the search of the computer, is one of the circumstances that this court should take into account in determining the totality of the circumstances.
Where is the legal... Please finish.
I'm sorry, there was just one other question. I do agree with Mr. Hinkle that if she had brought the computer out onto the porch, the only question would have been whether or not she had authority to consent to the computer search.
Where is the legal authority that adds to the question of who may give consent, which is the question we have before us now? As you said, I think there no longer is a contest as to the legality of the search of a laptop. That's gone by the wayside, as I understand the present posture of the case. As I understand, the present posture of the case really focuses on who may give consent. And where does this level of intrusion argument that you're discussing fall into the analysis of who may give consent? What case do you point to that, in answering that question, analyzes the level of intrusion?
Well, Tomlinson does.
Explain that to me, then.
Well, in Tomlinson, this court, where it was a teenage girl who gave the officers consent to enter, if you will, I mean, she didn't actually say anything. They said, is so-and-so here? I can't remember. I think it was her father. And they knew that he had teenage daughters, and she answered the door, and they said, is he here? And she turned around, and they followed her in. And this court did make a distinction between a consent to enter the house versus a consent to search the house. So to me, Tomlinson has recognized that. And certainly this is not the only court that has done so.
Well, that seems a little different. You are advancing that case stands for, there's a different threshold, perhaps bad use of term, about entering a house and searching a house. But what we are asking here is just, who may give consent to enter the house, aren't we?
Well, but I think that's exactly the question that was posed in Tomlinson, too. Who has authority to permit the police to walk into that house?
So you view that this is just an entry and that there was no search of the house because they came to see the computer, they found the computer quite simply, although is it clear in the record where the computer was?
Well, there was a search of the house, but it was pursuant to a warrant. That was
no,
later,
but is it clear where the...
That's all he did, was he looked at the computer.
Where was the computer physically?
It was on the couch. And according
where was
to
the
his,
couch?
Well, according to his testimony, it was 20 to 30 feet inside the living room.
In my house, 30 feet would be in the backyard, side yard, too.
Well, I mean, houses differ. In my house, you can't go 30 feet. You run into a wall. So I mean, I think
so
those kinds
where,
of
okay.
questions
so,
have... And again, I mean, I'm sure it was an estimate, and people do tend to overestimate distance.
Well,
but nevertheless,
but
it's
more
clear.
Than an entry. It's more oh, than right. an entry. He didn't just step over the threshold. He walked some distance.
He walked from the front door to wherever the computer
okay.
was,
so
which was on a...
When does it stop being an entry and start to be a search?
Well, I think that depends on the design of the house and where, as many courts have said, and it does flow from Professor Lefebvre's treatise, where guests would normally be received. If you normally receive the guest in the living room, then it's the living room. If you have a foyer and you don't go into either the living room or a family room or the kitchen or whatever, then it would be there. I mean,
but
it depends.
Mr. Weinstein, the state has the burden of proof here of reasonableness, doesn't it?
Right, it does.
And then we don't know where the computer was.
Oh, I think we do.
Well, we know
the
it's 20
made
to 30.
Findings, and it was in the living room on the sofa 20 to 30 feet inside.
Well, you know, they made that finding, but where's the evidence that it was in the living room? So you
evidence
know,
is Dorn's testimony. That's exactly what he testified to.
He said living room?
He said the living room. He said it was 20 to 30 feet inside. So I don't think the circuit court's findings are clearly erroneous by any means. And given that, that's where the computer was. Now, whether or not she had consent, Mr. Hinkle's right, that's a legal conclusion that this court draws without deference to the circuit court or the court of appeals, but nonetheless, it's clear from the testimony that the computer was in an area where guests would be received in that house.
Do you agree that the test is an objective one of the reasonable expectation of privacy of boyfriend, of the defendant here?
Oh, we don't question that he had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the house, no. We also believe, as I said, I think she had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the house also, because Olson tells us that she did. And to me, that means she has the right to consent in her own right. Now, the question about assuming the risk is a little more difficult in this case because he left her in charge of the house, so to speak. He left her there alone and went to work. Now, it seems to me that that act assumes the risk that someone at least might answer the door and allow somebody in the house. And I disagree that what you look for in these cases is whether or not you would allow a police officer in. If you have the authority to allow another individual in, then to me, that means you have the authority to allow the police. The police are in the same position as a meter reader, and it seems to me if MG&E had come in and said, hey, we need to read the meter, and she'd have said, come on in, I think he would not have, society would accept that.
The question here, I think, I believe, is who may consent? That's what the question is here. And you've got in our McGovern case, when we talked about who has the consent, you had this tent dweller, you know, out in the front yard who happened, you know. I mean, and you say, no, not that. You know, we won't go with that. It's the whole Goldilocks approach. You know, which one is just right? That one was just a little bit too remote. You talk about Tomlinson. Tomlinson, as I recall, was a case of apparent consent. There, the officers, there was a teenage girl who, as I recall, opened the door, and the officers thought that she was the daughter.
Right.
Right?
That's
and so,
correct.
I mean, that's if they think that she's the daughter, even though she wasn't the daughter, you think she's the daughter of Tomlinson, then she must live there, and so it was apparent consent, a co-inhabitant, right? Well,
but the question there, I'm sorry.
But for me, it's where do you draw the line here? Here we have a weekend person. Now, and it, there has to be a co-occupant or co-inhabitant. It's not just any old visitor. Do you agree with that? I mean, it can't be the tent dweller. We know that. The tent dweller was a visitor, so it can't be tent dweller.
I guess I'd have to ask you to define any old visitor.
Well,
because
can it be someone who's there for 2 hours that's never been there before, but the defendant says, hey, I've got to run and pick up my daughter at daycare. Why don't you stay? Make yourself at home. Would you be standing here and arguing, oh, that's just fine, that person has authority to give consent for law enforcement? Okay, so what is it? Where do you draw the line? 5 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours, not left alone. What's the test? We know the extremes, but this case presents something in between the extremes. Where do we draw the line? Time is one thing I take as a focus. You're saying weekend, which I assume is about 48 hours, is enough to imbue someone with co-inhabitant status. Hmm?
Well, I think the technical definition of someone as a co-inhabitant is someone who is staying there. I think an overnight guest is a co-inhabitant.
Okay, so one night
for that period of time.
So one overnight. Or if someone is a night worker, one during the day
I'm not saying that because we have to look at the totality of the circumstances.
Okay, but time is an important part. What time below which you can't go? 2 hours you wouldn't go. That's clear to me. I want to know what time is a threshold for you.
Well, I don't think it depends solely on the time. That's only one factor.
Okay, but the one factor of time, what's the threshold for you?
I don't think there is one.
Okay, 2 hours isn't enough.
And that's the problem.
2 hours isn't enough, apparently, so that's not the threshold.
Well, the Supreme Court says we don't do bright lines in this area.
Mm-hmm.
To me, if you say it has to be such and such an amount of time, that's a bright line. We don't do that in this
area.
Okay,
but what you can do is... Is 2 hours sufficient to imbue someone with co-inhabitant status? And I think the answer is no.
Well, I don't know, because it depends. If it's this person's child who's home from college for the weekend, maybe it is.
Well, that would be probably a co-inhabitant.
Well, but that's the whole problem. You can't look at just the time. You can't look at how long the person is a guest. You have to look at everything, and it makes a difference.
And what else do we look at here then?
Well,
that
I think you look
at that he was gone.
You look at she had a social relationship with him, mm-hmm. which is more than someone who just comes over to have coffee. She was an overnight guest, so she had a reasonable expectation of privacy herself. She was alone in the house. She had no restrictions placed on her. At least the record doesn't disclose anything. She had permission to use the computer. She was. She invited the police. I think that is another circumstance that you put into the mix. So I think you have to look at all of that.
What does the invitation go to? Level of intrusion in your analysis? I mean, what legal question does it go to?
I think it does matter. I think if you're asking, does she have permission to allow the policeman to walk into the living room, or does she have a permission to allow the police to search the kitchen? Yeah, the extent of that consent matters. That's part of the totality of the circumstances. And I think when you're talking about a lesser intrusion, then a guest of less connection with the premises does perhaps have, under the facts of the particular case, have the authority to consent. And to me, that's what Tomlinson was all about. Although in Tomlinson, it had to do with the relationship of the teenage daughter. What's the extent of the authority of a teenage daughter to let someone in their parents' house? But setting aside that focus, the question and the approach is really the same. Does Ms. Padilla have a sufficient relationship and under all the other circumstances to consent to the type of intrusion that occurred here? And I think you mentioned that Matlock says search, but that was what was at issue at Matlock, was a search. It's not surprising that that's what they would say, the court would say. So, yeah, I think it does matter that it was only a limited intrusion. We recognize that sort of thing when we make a distinction between a seizure for a traffic stop and a full-blown arrest. So why would we not make it for this? It's a lesser intrusion. It's not an unknown principle.
So how would you like the opinion written? Tell me.
I think what the action of Officer Dorn here was reasonable under all the circumstances.
It has to be tied to consent.
I'm sorry?
Doesn't it have to be tied to consent?
Well, the question is whether or not his judgment about whether he did have consent was reasonable. That's the question.
Is that an objective test Officer Dorn or subjective?
I'm sorry?
Is that an objective test?
An objective
or
test.
Objective. So could a reasonable police officer,
right,
under all these circumstances, think that
the authority
there was
to go
consent,
in and look at the computer,
that there was valid consent?
Right.
Well, not look at the computer. Enter or search, whichever you think is applicable.
Well, I don't know.
House.
See, I don't think under this case, under the facts of this case, I don't think that she would have authority to consent to a full-blown search of the house. I would agree with Mr. Hinkle to that extent.
So that's why
but
you
that's
have
not
a,
what happened here.
You have a short-blown consent.
Sorry?
Short-blown search of the house. Only you can enter and get into the living room.
Only to enter and look at the computer. I don't think he had authority to do anything other than look at the computer.
You know what? Somehow, somewhere, somebody thought there was no authority to look into the computer because they got a search warrant.
Well, they wanted to search the whole house.
Well, didn't they get a search warrant for the computer, too?
I'm sorry?
Did the search warrant cover the computer? I'm sorry.
I'm very sorry.
Did the search warrant cover the computer?
No.
That is, opening the computer?
No. They got a separate search warrant for the computer.
Okay, but there was a warrant for the opening and looking at the computer.
Right. They got two separate search warrants. One issued the same day that Ms. Padilla called the police.
I understand.
That was for the residence. And several days later, they got a search warrant for the computer.
For the computer. And we have previously held there may be a problem once you start looking into a computer without a warrant. Remember the telephone case where the telephone opened up and the it showed the defendant in that case in a pose that illustrated use of or access to drugs. But if they wanted to go further, they had to get a warrant for that. So
all he did prior to the warrant, all he did was look at the videos that Ms. Padilla identified.
Okay.
Oh, actually, they looked at one for sure. She identified some others, but I don't recall offhand whether they actually looked at the
other. So they looked for a search.
But they did look at one.
So you're saying they had enough authority, the consent was enough, or the consent was authorized on an objective basis to enter the house and get the computer.
And look at the computer, yeah.
That's all.
I think under the facts of this case, yeah, that would be all.
Search the house and not search the computer further. And not search the computer further.
Oh, yes. And he didn't. Right.
That's why you got two warrants in here.
Certainly one can think of arguments that would support searching the computer more at that point, but he seized it, so there was really no need, and they did, and I think that was justified based on his view of the video.
It was probable cause even under her own statements. She's not a confidential informant. She's just a general citizen. She says, I saw him. Police officers can trust that.
I'm sorry.
The police officers can trust that and use her statements as probable cause to get a warrant.
He did. Or he included it in the affidavit along with other things.
Then he had seen things that he could rely on.
He had seen it too. At least for the warrant for the computer was based on Officer Dorn's own observations also.
Why would a remand be necessary for your inevitable discovery argument based a little bit on the warrants that the chief was talking about?
Well, theoretically, it's whether it's inevitable discovery or independent source, I'm not sure. But the reason the argument's not developed is because the warrants weren't in the record. And they should, at least the affidavit for the search of the house should have been under the rules because it was marked as an exhibit at the preliminary hearing. And the rules say that the record on appeal includes exhibits, whether or not admitted. So that should have been part of the record. It wasn't. I could not argue based on Because what I have to demonstrate for that doctrine would be that if you excised what he saw in the house was what remained, in other words, what her description on the porch was that sufficient to establish probable cause? And without looking at the affidavit, I couldn't tell. So Mr. Hinkle has claimed several times that the state can't use that argument. My understanding for respondents is that they can defend the judgment on any theory, and that's a theory, so long as the record supports it. And that was the problem in this case, is the record didn't.
That's your problem. I mean, you could use any legal theory you want, but you can't use the legal theory
but I have
here
to have the facts.
Because you don't have the record, and you have to ask for remand. That's your problem.
That is correct, and that's why the argument's not in the brief. But I do think, given that it was the clerk's error, actually, that prohibited us from making that argument, that if we lose on the authority, we ought to have the opportunity to make the argument to the circuit court.
Well, you could have asked for a supplement of the record.
I'm sorry?
You could have asked to supplement the record. You
said I did, twice.
Twice, but you didn't get it.
Both in the Court of Appeals and in this court.
And here. And what about the concept that don't you get an opportunity to see the record in the trial court before it goes up?
I don't.
Oh, the DA does. Okay. So last I heard, the DA was a state officer, too.
That's true. On the other hand, they have a few cases to deal with besides just looking at the records. The other thing is, who knows what the arguments are going to be on appeal at the time that the clerk assembles the record. I mean, to me, to say, oh, the state or the appellant, for that matter, will know everything that they need to know from the record that should be in the record at the before they start doing research and briefing is wishful thinking. I mean, you just can't do that because I think that's why normally motions to supplement are pretty liberally granted and should be.
Counsel, although I was pushing you on this level of intrusion as part of your analysis, I'm now going to embrace it. In this sense, for me, a computer is a very private thing. It holds a lot of your life. Before a warrant was obtained, is it reasonable? Tell me why it's reasonable for a defendant to think that a person in Padella's situation would allow viewing of the computer. But the contents of the computer, not just that the computer exists. Because as I understand the facts, he looked at the contents of the computer. She showed him what was there.
Right, yeah. She
so
did.
So why would that be reasonable? Boy, I think...
Well, because he gave her consent.
I know, but is it reasonable
Project
to think
her
that
she
when
could
someone...
Use the computer.
When the MG&E person comes in to check the meter or whatever you said, that she would say... Oh, come on over and look at this computer. What's in the computer? Is that reasonable?
Well, I guess the only way I can answer that is to say I have yet to see a case where it's undisputed that the owner of a computer said to somebody, you can use the computer, and a court has said that person doesn't have authority to consent to a search of the computer, mm-hmm. or at least to look at what they looked at.
So if I said to someone, oh, you can use my computer and you can Google whatever you want or go to Wikipedia, or I know you're going to be using it for making documents, that you think that my consent to someone to do the computer is consent to search all of the stuff I got on the computer. So to me, it's like saying to a house guest, please make yourself at home. I do not expect the house guest to open my file drawers and find my financial records or find my tax returns. I mean, they can use the toaster, but I don't expect them to snoop into personal documents. And the opening a computer other than to do your business on the computer, is that authority for the user to snoop into all the private drawers, files, folders, or whatever you want to call it, that are in that computer? Is that more like my filing cabinet at home?
Well, I think we're seeing a lot of litigation over that right now.
Issue. That's the very issue that's being litigated, I think,
right.
Around the country.
Yes, there are.
Right. The files in the cabinet versus the files in the computer.
That's
so it's
right.
Not quite
especially
so easy.
Yeah, especially right. In terms of email. Yeah, that it's true. Okay. And
that's why I think you have to take great care, and that's why I think the state properly got a search warrant or properly attempted to cover its problems by getting a search warrant. Just like with the GPS, you needed a search warrant.
Well, that's certainly the way Mr. Perlman trains the police, yes.
Exactly. And so the issue here is, as you correctly stated, in my opinion, the search of the computer is out. What we have to deal with is whether you call it an entry, limited search, or you call it a search of the house, the most private effect or house or whatever you want to, however you want to phrase it.
Yes, that's the Fourth Amendment.
Right, house in effect.
Issue, and I think Mr. Hinkle's correct about that.
I do too. Okay. But the answer is not so clear.
Right. We'll disagree over the answer.
Right, but at least we got the issue. Right. Well, that's a good start. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hinkle.
I have very few points to make in response. First of all, with respect to remand and whether the record supports the state's theory, I mean, it's not the case that even if the warrants were in the record, there would be enough to sustain the judgment on either independent source or inevitable discovery, because both of those would require that the warrants be shown to be independent of the initial search, which means that it would be required that the state show that Officer Dorns, having seen the images on the computer, didn't contribute to that. And there's no testimony on that point. It's testimony that could have been put on at the initial suppression hearing, but was not.
The court has had cases, and frankly, as I remember them, the two doctrines here slide into each other.
They're related.
They're related. It's a matter of drawing the line, and that related the Murray case, as I remembered. But, okay. You think they needed more testimony. That's your point?
Yes, absolutely. And I don't think that there's any reason they couldn't have put that on initially. And then I wanted to address, the state suggested that in Matlock what they were talking about is a search and they didn't really concern themselves with an entry. But the language in both Olson and Payton says that entry, it talks about having the authority to consent to an entry. Well, Payton isn't about consent. What it says is that any breach of the entry brings forth the full protection of the Fourth Amendment. There aren't different levels of intrusion into the house. This is an area in which the Supreme Court has drawn a bright line, and that line is the front door. They say it innumerable times. Sometimes there is a gray area to a certain extent, and that's outside the house, the curtilage. There's sometimes some differentiation there between whether or not there's an expectation of privacy. But the court has never suggested that there's some specific chamber of the house that's more protected than any other part of the house. The Fourth Amendment doesn't say people have the right to be secure in their bathrooms and kitchen cupboard. It says in their houses. And I think that's all I have to say, unless the court has further questions.
Did we reject the argument in McGovern? I don't know the answer to this. I'm asking. Did we reject the argument in McGovern that there is a difference of the full breadth of the Fourth Amendment protection between entry and search?
Yes, you did. In that case, the state suggested that, because what happened factually was that the officers knock on the door, and the house is kind of arranged. I think there's a stairway in front and a room to the right where, the people were, the person, I think, with the joint. And the state suggested that, since the officer just knocked on the door and this Martirosian, the tent dweller, only opened the door and let him into the foyer, that's not really a search, that's just an entry, and therefore Martirosian's consent was good enough. And this court said no, and there's some sort of strong language there saying that, they had an expectation of privacy, they kept their front door closed and had a legitimate expectation of privacy, and in order to cross that threshold, a warrant was required.
Are there any other questions? If not, thank you, Mr. Hinkle. I want to thank both counsel for yet another argument on the Fourth Amendment, search and seizure, and in this instance, a consent, and by whom the court, as you both know, has had a number of cases, and they turn on the particular facts and concepts of law applicable across every threshold. And that concludes our argument in 10 AP 3034 CR, State versus Kenneth M. Sobachek.